Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 620, titled Interview with Paris Flamand About the Masks of New Orleans. This program is being recorded on November 25th of the year 2007. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Paris Flamand, the author of, among other titles, The Kennedy Conspiracy from 1969 and, more recently, The Assassination of America, a four-volume encyclopedic series which not only details the assassination of President Kennedy, its investigations, its implications, but also to an extent memorializes those people who have undertaken to bring the truth to light. And a lot of those people are no longer with us. But happily, Paris Flamand is. Paris, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Dave, it's always a pleasure to be with you, and I'm looking forward to this evening.
By the way, I should have added, perhaps, citing your credentials, you were for many years the producer of the Long John Nebel Show, in many ways the daddy or the parent of radio talk shows. So it's sort of in addition to your work on the Kennedy Conspiracy, which helped to launch me on my direction, I guess you could say you helped to shape the genre itself. Well, The Masks of New Orleans, and by the way, people who are emailing or writing this down or whatever, that's spelled M-A-S-Q-U-E-S. That is the title of the second of your four-volume series,
yes.
And it deals with Jim Garrison's investigation, New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's investigation into President Kennedy's assassination. It was your experience, and I would say privilege, to work with Jim Garrison. And why don't you perhaps review for us how you came to work with Jim Garrison? And also, having worked with him, having gotten to know him, tell us about who Jim Garrison was. Where did he come from? Who was he? What were some of his tastes? Tell us a little bit about his professional and personal background.
Well, it's interesting because Jim, like so many people who became celebrated in a negative way sometimes in his own lifetime, and much more so now that he has died, he is mostly unknown in terms of his personal origins and just how he became what he became, a legend. Jim was born in Denison, Iowa, on November 20th, 1921, with the name Ealing, that's E-A-L-I-N-G, Carruthers Garrison. The Jim came later. His parents were divorced when he was about three, and his mother, a high school teacher, took him to Chicago to live. He had little contact with his father thereafter, said father living mostly in Arizona. And his mother was usually relatively nearby. She lived a long time in Laurel, Mississippi. In World War II, while he was still, of course, a young man, he flew an unarmed artillery spotter plane over the German lines, a task which, by the way, had about an 80% fatality rate, and later returned to the United States and Tulane University Law School, where he took his degree. Now, let's see, he spent a brief time with the FBI. Now, I recall he told me he left because he thought it was boring. And during the Korean War, he was briefly called back to service, which led him to become a lieutenant colonel in the Louisiana National Guard. On being separated from the military, he became involved in the political aspects of law enforcement, became a city attorney, then an assistant district attorney in New Orleans, and his personality and expertise certainly attracted a great deal of attention, and newspapers began to call him the Jolly Green Giant. Mostly because he weighed 240 pounds and stood 6'6". That's something to give one pause, try to imagine this extremely well-dressed. He was very conscious of the elegance of clothes and had great taste. This giant of a man, 6'6", 240 pounds, in terms of direct contact. It was very difficult to spend time with Jim and not be overwhelmed. It took two or three hours with him that one began to realize that he was friendly and cordial and very receptive to other people's ideas. He became district attorney in 1960, and the legend began. Then, of course, he was reelected and reelected, and then later on, when he was forced out by the acrimonious and even venomous assaults on him and his character, curiously enough, he was still able to be elected judge and then reelected again. So his career, while permeated with vilification and concentrated and organized vilification by the powers that were then, and I'm afraid still prevail, and even having a negative effect on his marriage. But fortunately, although he was divorced, he and his wife got back together again in later years, which was very beneficial to, of course, his children, of which he had several. And so that was, for those who wonder who is this man that people talk about regarding the assassination, well, that in the tiniest thumbnail sketch was Jim Garrison.
And by the way, we perhaps should also mention that his intellectual stature was equal to his physical stature. And he was, in addition to obviously his legal skills, he was a Shakespearean scholar and was influenced to a considerable extent by the Bard.
Yes, well, as a matter of fact, the first session I had with him when I flew down, and we'll talk about that later, was I met him at his office, and he said almost the opening line was, well, we'll get to that in a moment, do you play chess? And I admitted that I was a victim of that particular indulgence, and unfortunately, the one time we had the chance to set up the pieces and go at it, I had opened with something known as the Catalan opening, and he said he had heard of it, but he hadn't seen it before, and it obviously didn't matter much because he had evened things off in a matter of about 8 or 10 moves. And then I think it was Lou Ivan, his chief district attorney, assistant attorney, came in and called his attention to matters that had to be dealt with immediately. And unfortunately, we were never able to finish the game.
At the individual was larger than life in many ways, and so
in every way, yes,
and impressed people in that particular regard. Most in from what I've been able to read, I was not privileged to know Mr. Garrison myself, but he impressed most people in that regard, in a multidimensional sort of Renaissance man capability. Now, review for us, if you would, Paris, how you came to be in contact with Jim Garrison, and how did this collaboration take shape?
Well, in a few sentences, I'll explain how I got involved in the entire assassination scenario. It was a warm, sunny day, if those who were in New York at the time would recall, and I was in my Greenwich Village studio beside an open window typing on a new book. Outside, there was a cab driver sitting in his taxi, lunching on a Hero sandwich and a bottle of beer. He was listening to music, and the date was November 22, 1963. Suddenly, the sidewalk melodies were interrupted. A bulletin came over, ladies and gentlemen, we have just received an announcement from Dallas, Texas, where the president is visiting. We have been told that shots have been fired at the motorcade in which he and Mrs. Kennedy are riding. There was a pause and then an announcement there would be more information immediately. They had it. And, it could not have been more than 5 minutes later. The announcement came over the cab driver's radio. Ladies and gentlemen, we have just been informed that the President of the United States is dead. Within a matter of minutes, my telephone rang, and it was Eric Norden, a friend, a brilliant young writer with whom I had put on the air in my capacity as a producer of the legendary Long John Neville radio show in New York, and who incidentally was the person to write the first important article on the assassination, only about 10 days after it occurred. It appeared in the Minority of One. And he asked, have you heard? And I said, yes, of course. And he said, coup d'etat, right? And I said, certainly, I imagine so. And he said, we'll talk when we have more news. Well, then many other things intervened, and including the Warren Commission and the United States government having no interest whatever in the assassination of one of the most beloved presidents of modern times. And so a couple of years passed, several, as a matter of fact, and Eric called again one afternoon and told me he had been assigned by Playboy, for whom he'd already done several pieces, to fly down to New Orleans and interview Jim Garrison, who was already creating a considerable stir with his newly initiated investigation into the murder of the president. That is, he was rejecting the Warren Commission's lone assassin theory and was looking into evidence that a conspiracy had killed Kennedy and had begun in New Orleans, and that Oswald had not functioned alone. Norden asked or suggested, why don't you see if your agent can get you a magazine assignment to do a piece on Garrison, and we can fly down together. I told him I'd check, and I called my agent and gave him the scenario that Norden had suggested, and he said he'd call me back in half an hour or so, and he did. Excuse me. However, he told me that the men's magazines, Saga, Argosy, etc., were interested, but none was willing to put up the $1,000 or $1,500 for upfront traveling, hotel, etc. expenses. And I replied resignedly, well, I'll go back to the book I'm doing. And Don, my agent, said, no, that is not all. I've spoken to Meredith Press, and they want a book on Garrison. Can you do that and finish The Age of Flying Saucers, which was what I was doing, at the same time, simultaneously? And I assured him that I could do both books at the same time. That would be the response of any sane author. And as they were both, very different in style and content and what have you. And so I called Eric, made arrangements to fly with him to New Orleans and meet Garrison. And in between my speaking to Don and Eric, I had called to Garrison's office and assured myself that getting an interview with him would be no problem. And so within a few days, we flew down, and within a few days, I was in the district attorney's office with my Ewer tape recorder and beginning my association with him, which was to last for a number of years.
We should perhaps at this point, Paris, just pause for a minute and briefly recount for the listening audience, particularly for younger members, just what exactly Garrison's investigation was about. And, of course, the official investigation was that, quote, investigation, Lee Harvey Oswald, a lone nut, shot President Kennedy for no particular reason, because he couldn't get enough sex or whatever. Pick a particular reason. And that Jack Ruby, another lone nut assassin, killed President Kennedy because he didn't want Mrs. Kennedy to experience the grief of going back to Dallas for a trial to testify. In fact, Jim Garrison came across events in the city of New Orleans that fundamentally undermined the official investigation. Tell us about sort of the jumping off point. Tell us about how Jim Garrison came to begin to sort through the masks of New Orleans, and masks, again, M-A-S-Q-U-E-S, in the theatrical reference.
Yes, well, initially, Jim thought that Oswald was involved, probably the shooter. However, let me get to that in a moment. At first, our relationship was, of course, somewhat formal. My tendency more than his. He was very affable. And as we got to know each other, and he began revealing to me the names of the local participants as he envisioned them in some kind of overall schemata that led to the killing of the president. And one of the key people, excuse me, very, very important in the entire inquiry was a private detective named Guy Bannister. He was a one-time FBI agent out of Chicago, and which was particularly interesting to me later on because that was the city of origin of Jack Ruby and of many of his nefarious, if very low-level, connections. And another person that Jim was most interested in was a David Perry, a very curious flyer and sometimes soldier of fortune, a probable gunrunner, and a entirely different type of individual, a very debonair, elegant man named Clay Shaw, who whom I will speak of in more detail in a moment. Jim also mentioned that some of his people in this scenario were somehow connected to a group called the Old Catholic Church, about which he was extremely vague, and that was understandable, because very few people at that time and even today know much about what it is. But he was surprised, and I think very pleased, to discover that it was a subject about which I knew a great deal. And at his request, over the following months, I researched the affiliations of some of his persons of interest in respect to their connection with the various subsects of the church. And also, at his request, I looked into an organization, a Swiss organization known as Permindex, and another one in Europe known as the Centro Mondiale Commerciale, all of which had intelligence connections there and in this country. We had immediately established that Bannister and Ruby, of course, was already known, and Clay Shaw and Perry were probably very important elements in the New Orleans aspect of the assassination. Garrison's perception of Oswald, and this is another thing that reflects your noting his intellectual capacity earlier on, he was not fixed in his ideas. He was always susceptible to the implications of new evidence and new testimony and what have you. Excuse me. As I say, originally, his perspective of the assassination characterized Oswald, who incidentally, most people don't know anything about him, really. He was born on October 18, 1939, much younger than most people realize. And Jim's perception initially was that he was most likely the marksman. After his inquiries gathered more and more facts and testimony, and he got a more informed perspective, he became convinced that the involvement was less likely that important, concluding that that Oswald, who had joined the Civil Air Patrol in 1956, was not a marksman, but was merely a shooter who was a tool. And even this became modified to his thinking as he decided that he was a manipulated individual who was likely not involved in the plot at all, and that Oswald himself asserted he was a patsy, and Jim came to the conclusion that he probably was. And finally, in our last conversations, he had concluded that a web of intrigue had been woven around Oswald, and that it was extremely likely he was entirely ignorant of all the matter in which he was had been caught up, and that very likely he was not where he was alleged to have been, did not do what he was alleged to have done, and should be regarded as not a, a player in the plot, but really a victim.
The Masks of New Orleans, extending that metaphor. 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place. That mask, so to speak, that front, was one of the points of intersection of Guy Bannister, David Ferry, and apparently also Lee Harvey Oswald. Tell us how the Masks of New Orleans figures on 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place, the Newman Building, and how that building in turn and those people's intersection with it figured into Jim Garrison's investigation.
Well, that is, was sort of a convection of, as you say, Bannister's. Actually, that was the location of Bannister's office. Bannister was a Louisianan. He was born in Caldwell Parish, I think, March 7th, I think, 1901. And went to local public schools in Louisiana State University and the very conservative Soul College of New Orleans. And a number of years that followed, about six or seven, are very cloudy. I have not been able to find much about them, nor have I found any investigator who does know that period. But by 1929, he was a police investigator in Monroe, Louisiana. And when the chief of that department died, when people die in this scenario, one always takes pause. According to him, he assumed that office as acting or as the virtual chief. 5 years afterwards, I believe it was in November 1934, he was sworn in as an agent of the Division of Investigations of the Department of Justice, soon to be renamed the Bureau of Investigation, FBI. And he served in various locations, about five or six, as I recall, in the following years. But this may not be something you know, and I find it most interesting. He was serving in Butte, Montana in 1937. In any event, Bannister became a special agent in charge of the office, Chicago office of the FBI. That would be January 1st, 1954. And his eminence in the Bureau was rather short-lived because he was separated from it on December 12th of the same year. And the machinations of Bannister and his activity relating to the assassination with David Ferry, a number of anti-Castro Cubans, organizations that were to the far right and were all congregated with the presence on various occasions of David Ferry, Oswald, and numerous other people that are secondary or tertiary in the scenario of the New Orleans scene at his office is one of the more pertinent things, but which has been pretty well ignored by the people who simply wish to obscure what really has happened in the in the assassination of the president.
In side two, and we're almost at the end of side one, Paris, let's stitch together a little more closely some of the people behind some of the masks of New Orleans and see how people like Guy Bannister and David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald intersect with people like Carlos Marcello and Clay Shaw, two people we haven't talked about very much, but two people who are, I guess one could say, two of the more important masks in that particular procession.
Well, there are also others of which those are very major figures, but there are others which I'm happy to say yet at least a chapter in the book. A Perry Raymond Russo was very important in the scene down there. Dean Adams Andrew, a lawyer, who was an extraordinary character and personality. Gordon Ovell, whom some people associate with intelligence operations and some people think was just a self-serving, self-mythologizing individual. But the cast of characters is absolutely extraordinary. And, of course, none was more peculiar than David Ferry. Although you mentioned Carlos Marcello, who was actually Colo de Daro Minicore, was born in Tunis, North Africa. Of course, he was Sicilian, and he came to New Orleans as a boy in 1911. Early on, he was roamed with the criminal gangs down there, and he was allied with the crime boss, Sylvester Sam Carollo, who was the powerhouse until he got himself so involved in the law that he wasn't able to function anymore, and so Marcello pretty well took over.
We are, Paris, we're going to have to talk about a lot of these characters inside, too, because we are out of time. But we do have time to tell people how to get a hold of The Assassination of America. Bear in mind that we can't mention prices on the air.
Well, everything we have spoken about is dealt with doubly, triply, quadruply in the book, especially in book two, which you have mentioned several times, Mask of New Orleans, which is the, as is self-evident, is the New Orleans Jim Garrison aspect of the case. But if anyone who wants more information about procuring them, they need to write only to me, Box 48, Sciota, that's S-C-I-O-T-A, Pennsylvania, 18356 and four six, and I'll send them whatever information they need to procure the books. And incidentally, it is only available now since all of them are out in the complete 4-volume set.
All righty, and bear in mind that WFMU and Spitfire will be archiving the audio files of this particular program, our WFMU, permanently. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 620, interview with Paris Flamand about the masks of New Orleans. This program is being recorded on November 25th of the year 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for Paris Flamand. Thanks for listening.